So we have to understand that when a trauma happens to us, it changes us. Literally, it causes a chemical change in our DNA. And this can change how our genes function, hey, sometimes for generations. Technically, there's this trauma. And now in our body, there are chemical signals which fire in our cells. Mm-hmm. They call them chemical tags or epigenetic tags. And these attach to the DNA, and they tell the cells to use or ignore certain genes enabling us to better deal with this trauma. And this will change how we act or how we feel. For example, we can become sensitive, oversensitive, or reactive to situations that are similar to this event, even if the event occurred in a past generation, which I'll get into. So that we have a better chance of surviving it in this generation. I want to give an example here.
Yes.
Let's say our grandparents came from a war-torn country, similar to what's happening now in the world. People are being shot. Bombs are going off. Uniformed men are lining people up in the square, taking them away. Our grandparents would develop and pass forward a skill set, reactions to the violence.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. In this week's episode, I sit down with renowned trauma expert and best-selling author, Mark Wallin, author of It Didn't Start With You, and we explore the powerful realities of inherited family trauma, attachment wounds, epigenetics, and emotional healing. Mark shares how unresolved trauma from parents, grandparents, and even earlier generations can unconsciously shape our anxiety, self-sabotage, relationships, health, and emotional regulation. We unpack what inherited trauma really is, how epigenetics influences emotional and physical health, the role of attachment wounds in early childhood experiences, core language, core sentences, and identifying trauma patterns, reparenting and healing the inner child, family constellations and generational healing, men's emotional regulation, anger, and maternal attachment dynamics, and then the intersection of spirituality and trauma recovery. So you can appreciate this episode is jam-packed with quality information. Mark Wallin is a leading expert in inherited family trauma and the director of the Family Constellation Institute in the United States. He's renowned for bridging epigenetics, neuroscience, and somatic healing. Mark's work explores how unresolved trauma from parents, grandparents, and previous generations can manifest in our lives as anxiety, depression, obsessive thoughts, relationship struggles, and chronic health conditions. He is the best-selling author of It Didn't Start With You, an international bestseller that has sold more than 3 million copies worldwide, won the Silver Nautilus Book Award for Psychology, and has been translated into 42 languages. Mark has recently released a fully revised 2025 edition of It Didn't Start With You, along with the official It Didn't Start With You workbook, offering readers practical tools to identify and heal generational trauma. Please check out all the ways you can find Mark's work, whether it's online or purchasing his book. And before we jump into the episode, a quick reminder that listening to this podcast does not establish a therapeutic relationship. This podcast is solely for educational and informational purposes and has no affiliation with my therapeutic work. If you do require support, please reach out to a licensed professional. Now, let's just jump into the episode.
Mark, welcome to Easy Conversations. I'm really excited to talk with you today. As I mentioned, big fan of your work. Kept this book just handy here for people that can see that are watching the video. But for people that are listening, the book is It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. And I just want to thank you for, I'm sure you get this a lot, but thank you for the work you've done, because when I read this book pre-pandemic, I was able to subconsciously recognized that there was some trauma I was carrying, and it allowed me to mend my relationship with my father and touch base with him and talk to him about things that I was feeling for most of my life. And after going through some difficult situations, it gave me the humility and understanding that he also was a man making mistakes like we all do. And it allowed us to deepen our bond. So I really appreciate it being able to read that book and make sense of it all. So thank you for that. But I think it's worth maybe diving into right off the bat, what is inherited trauma and how do you make sense of it? How do we understand it?
That's a good question. Let's say your life's on track and you're ticking off all the boxes and doing all the right things. You have a good education, good job. You're partnered with the right person. But every morning you wake up feeling incredibly alone, or you struggle with panic attacks. So the answer to what's going on with us, to pretty much the answer to our suffering, could lie in a trauma that happened to one of our parents and grandparents. Mm-hmm. Maybe their mother or father died when they were young, or maybe one of our parents were sent away to live with relatives, or placed in foster care, or one of their siblings died tragically. Some event, mm-hmm. some trauma, something like this can devastate the family. And what I wrote this book for, because what I wanted people to understand is that the reaction of a trauma doesn't necessarily stop with the people who experienced it. So the feelings, yes. the sensations, specifically the stress response, the way our genes express, this can pass forward to the children and grandchildren, affecting them in a similar way, even though they didn't personally experience the trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I know there was a lot of stories you had shared in the book around people recognizing that, but then also going back. And sometimes it's not possible, right? If your grandparent or great-grandparent experienced something and you've inherited it. So what do people do in those situations when they know that there's something that they're carrying that's not theirs? And it was interesting to see in some of the stories you had shared that when they were able to connect the dots, whether it was talking to other family members, it provided a lot of healing. But how do you put all of that together? I'm just curious.
That's why I wrote the book and workbook. One of the things, I know you said you read the pre-pandemic version.
Yes.
But I just came out with the revised edition because there's all this new science and all my new insights. And then I also said, look, I can't work with everybody in the world. So I designed a workbook for people to take their personal healing to the next level. It's I often say the head needs to know so the body can let go. That's what I do in the book. I teach somebody how to listen to their trauma language, to hear the things that they say, to look at their behaviors, to look at their relationships, to look at the ways they deal with money and success, all of it, and to track that to where that trauma language began, often to a trauma that one of our parents or grandparents experienced, or to a break in the attachment with our mom when we were small. So there's this whole landscape. I want to talk about attachment for a minute. Sure. There's this whole landscape pre-memory. When we're in the womb, and then in the first 2-3 years of life before we have memory, this is the most important time for neurodevelopment. This is when our brain is being wired for safety or lack of safety, well-being or lack of well-being, feeling at ease or hypervigilant. And this is a time we have no memory. So I'm always telling people it's important. In fact, before I work with people, I send them a list of questions that they can ask their mom and dad if they're alive, but to find out what happened when they themselves were in the womb and in the first few years of life, but also to find out what happened to our parents when they were small. Often In Indian culture, for example, the aunt and or uncle that doesn't have children themselves, it's very reasonable for someone who has a lot of children to give one of the kids. And so now there's this massive break in the bond. And it's important that we know that that happened to our mother or father or grandmother or grandfather. Also, when we're asking these questions for Khan, we need to know, Mom, what were you thinking and feeling when you got pregnant? What did you want to, first of all, were you pregnant out of wedlock or were you guys married? Next, did you like each other? Did you feel that I wanted to have kids with dad? And dad, did you feel you wanted to have kids with mom? Or did one of you feel trapped? Or were you thinking of breaking up? Or did you not want to keep the baby? You were thinking, should we even keep this baby? Or was somebody cheating or drinking or fighting or separating? All these things are important. Our mother's mental and emotional state during the pregnancy with us and in the first few years of life is paramount. I find that even though I'm the inherited trauma guy for Khan, I find that 85% of us have breaks in the attachment with our mom, but only about 50% of us realize it because we haven't asked about this history.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other things that's coming up for me, I want to get your thoughts on is I've heard so many people say they can't snap out of just things, either they're self-sabotaging or things aren't working out for them. And I've heard people describe themselves as being cursed.
Yeah.
How do you handle those situations when you have people presenting that saying, I'm cursed? And is there an aspect
of a good word for it, but it's not really cursed. Yeah. There are unresolved traumas living in the family history that create repetitions. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. A woman, she's in her 20s. She kills all her relationships. She doesn't realize that the trauma really lives with her grandmother, but what she's doing is choosing all the wrong guys. So one relationship after another crashes and burns. She's blaming herself. She thinks she's cursed. She thinks she's defective. Her self-esteem is in the gutter. And she thinks there's either this family curse because all the women are widowed or unhappy or divorced, or she thinks something happened in her childhood. But if you look at her childhood, sometimes it's pretty okay. It's pretty average. But she doesn't understand why her life is spiraling. So I'm thinking of one woman in particular. What she didn't realize is there was a trauma that happened to her grandmom. When grandmom was in her 20s, she was suddenly widowed. Grandpa dies in a car accident and she never marries again. She stays alone. And then mom unconsciously leaves dad in her 20s. And then she stays alone. And now her client, the woman in her 20s, she doesn't understand her aloneness and why she's choosing all the wrong guys, but there's an unconscious loyalty to the members of our family who suffered. It's almost as though, mom, dad, I can't have more than you. If your life doesn't go well, I can't have a life that's happier or better. When, of course, that's what our parents want for us. So there's that, or there's... In the epigenome, there's a transcription. There's a trauma which converts to fight, flight, freeze responses, reactivity, reactions to the trauma, which then turns into a mechanism like DNA methylation or histone modifications or levels of non-coding RNA, which then changes the way the genes express. Well, I'm sure you're going to ask me the science, and I want to talk about the science because I think we... Let me just, do you mind if I kind of just go into the science? Because I think we really need to know what happens here.
Yeah, I do have a question around that for sure. And I know it's obvious that we're both passionate about this. I do want to maybe take a couple of steps back and definitely come back to the science piece. But I am curious to understand how you got into this work. What led you to, it's not like you just wake up one day and say, I'm going to work on inherited family trauma, or do you?
There's two stories here. One is my personal experience, which is what I think you're asking me, which I'll tell. And another one is the very first case that taught me how to look for inherited trauma. Maybe that'll come up or not, but I certainly will talk about myself for just a little. Like many of us, I had symptoms that I couldn't explain. About 30 some years ago, 35 years ago now, I started to lose the vision in one of my eyes. And I'm diagnosed with this chronic form of central serous retinopathy, but the kind that doesn't get better, the kind that keeps, you know, keeps getting worse. So the way it's progressing, the doctors are telling me, not only can we not cure it, but we think you're going to lose the vision in your other eye too. And you can imagine, for Con, I'm pretty freaked out. Mm-hmm. And they're telling me, I go, why do I have this? And I'm just in my early 30s. And they're telling me, stress. And what does that mean? So I'm desperate to find help. So I go on this search. I go on this search for healing, which literally leads me halfway around the world, as far as Indonesia, where I'm learning from several wise teachers who are teaching me some fundamental principles, one of which you brought up earlier, which is the importance of healing our relationships with our parents. So, but my relationship with my parents was so broken that before I could do that, I had to heal what stood in the way, which was I didn't know it at the time, but it was inherited family trauma, specifically the anxiety that I had inherited from all my grandparents. Each one of them were orphaned in some way. Three of them lose their mothers when they're babies or toddlers. And the fourth one loses her dad at one. And basically she loses her mother in the grief for a year. So this anxiety was the real cause of my vision loss. And when I inherited this feeling of being broken from a mother's love, because that was true for all my grandparents. There's a story when I'm five years old, my mom leaves the house and I go into a panic as a little boy and I run into her rooms and open her drawers and I'm crying into her scarves and nightgowns, smelling the smell, thinking, oh, she's never coming back. And all I'm going to have left is this smell, which was true for the grandparents whose mothers, one fell through the ice and died. Another one died in childbirth. My grandparents' mothers died suddenly. So maybe that's all they did have left was the smell of her garment. Anyway, after healing the break in the bond with my mom, which was really hard because I didn't trust her love at all. But after healing it, which I did, my sight came back for Con. And then I realized that, okay, all right, I'm onto something here. And then I felt compelled to share the principles that I had learned and ultimately developed a method for healing the effects of inherited family trauma.
Yeah. And I think I do want to come back to the other story where you said you came across a case too, but I think this is a good segue into the science part because you talked about or alluded to epigenetics, and obviously, scientifically, we're seeing that, right? Based on the choices we make or the environments we're in, we can turn on certain genes, turn off certain genes. But to me, the way I even look at it in my therapeutic work is that gives us so much more agency that you're not necessarily bound to your genetic makeup, even though you may feel that way. Based on choices you can make or the choices you do make, you can actually heal. And you change the course of your life and future generations from there. But help us understand the scientific part, because there's so much insight in your own story there too, of how it affected your vision too, right?
I like what you said about agency. So we'll talk about the science, but you're right. I said it earlier and I'll say it again, the head needs to know so the body can let go. Now, sometimes we can't know because we're adopted or our parents won't talk. And I'll get into that too, because that the behaviors are still there. the language is still there in our trauma language. And in a sense, we don't need to know, but we do need to know what we, how we're suffering. We do need to examine why we're saying that phrase or why we're repeating those broken relationships, because that's a language too. Remember when I talked about that girl in her 20s and she keeps ruining all her relationships? That's a language. If she follows it, then she knows to look back at the relationship with her mother losing, her grandmother losing her husband, and then her mother separating at the same age. But science, I think that's good. So we have to understand that when a trauma happens to us, it changes us. Literally, it causes a chemical change in our DNA. And this can change how our genes function, hey, sometimes for generations. Technically, there's this trauma. And now in our body, there are chemical signals which fire in our cells. They call them chemical tags or epigenetic tags. And these attach to the DNA. And they tell the cells to use or ignore certain genes, enabling us to better deal with this trauma. And this will change how we act or how we feel. For example, we can become sensitive, oversensitive, or reactive to situations that are similar to this event, even if the event occurred in a past generation, which I'll get into, so that we have a better chance of surviving it in this generation. I want to give an example here.
Yes.
Let's say our grandparents came from a war-torn country, similar to what's happening now in the world. People are being shot. Bombs are going off. Uniformed men are lining people up in the square, taking them away. Our grandparents would develop and pass forward a skill set, reactions to the violence. Let's say sharper reflexes. That's a positive reaction. Or quicker reaction times. Hey, that's a positive reaction. But they could also develop a startle response to loud noises, let's say. And this gets passed forward. And here we are receiving this startle response with the dial set to 10, waiting for this war, this catastrophe that never arrives. But all of a sudden, we're at a cocktail party. Somebody drops a glass on the ground and we duck behind a couch. Yeah. So we have this startle response that's heritable, that literally lives in the epigenome. And then the thing is, Furkan, we rarely make this link that our anxiety, our hypervigilance, our startle response, our depression is connected to our parents and grandparents. We just walk around thinking we're wired this way. And that's what I see all the time. This is who I am. How do you know? How do you know this is who you are? Let's get you some agency.
Yes. Yeah. And as you were sharing that, another thing was coming up for me because I read Peter Levine's book a few years ago, too, The Unspoken Voice. And he talks about, it's kind of the same thing, but he talks more about the energy that gets trapped in the body when we have trauma, right? And how to release it. So it's the same thing, right? Where we've got all this excess energy that needs to be released in one way or another.
What Peter's talking about, or what we're going to talk about here, are these fight, flight, freeze responses that never went all the way. That we never, these, for example, a fight response is we're tight, or we're pushing away something, we're feeling a threat, our upper body, our arms, our chest, it's going out. Or there's a flight response. We're actually going the other way, concave. We're pulling back. We're leaving out the back body because we feel this threat. Or a freeze response. We're shutting down. We go numb. We feel empty, hollow, disappeared, disconnected. And so this trapped energy never completes all the way. And so we're reliving it and then repeating traumas for a chance of a better outcome, as Freud said. As Freud said 100 years ago, in repetition compulsion, the trauma is actually looking for a better outcome. I would say it this way, that contraction in the trauma response is looking for its expansion. so that we will repeat these traumas so that expansion finally happens. So what do we need to do? We need to integrate these fight, flight, freeze responses. One of the ways I teach it in my book is to put your hand on these young parts, these inner child parts, these fight, flight, freeze responses, which are our inner child, and to say, I've got you. Hey, I'm going to breathe with you until you feel held and seen. I'm going to say, Mom couldn't see us, but I see you. And I'm going to hold you and breathe with you until you feel safe. And I'm going to bring you deep into the energetic core where there's life-giving sensations like waves of energy, waves of warmth, pulsing, tingling, but where we feel aliveness.
Yes. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah.
Well, and I want to pick up on that because
I answered your question.
Yes, you did. But so I work with a lot of men, and one of the common things that come up is their inability to emotionally regulate. And unfortunately, that often gets shown up or shows up as anger. And one of the things we talk about, the reason why I'm bringing this up is you talked about that inner child, right? And a lot of these men I talk to, they often revert back to this younger version of themselves that wasn't probably seen, heard, or understood. And it keeps showing up in all these interactions where they're experiencing the same feeling. They just don't know how to put words to it. And they revert back to this younger version. And it's just identifying that. And I'm glad you mentioned it, but is that also that form of recognizing, okay, my needs weren't met as a child and I'm repeating the same language as you've
repeating this experience of being angry and shut down because I'm looking into myself so that I can catch it, breathe with it, integrate it, and then I have more choices how I react out in the world. But you bring up something interesting around men, and I'm going to share it. In my work, one of the most common dynamics I see with men is that their mothers didn't like their fathers, and instead, they liked the son more. And the son felt, in a way, responsible for his mother's feelings. He felt responsible to make his mom feel okay. He felt that he needed to be there for his mom, literally leave his core energetically and energetically organize around his mother's feeling states. Now, wait a minute. So now what happens? Now he goes into a relationship later and he superimposes the mother over the partner. So when the partner has a want or a need, even a natural want or a need, he's feeling inundated and overwhelmed and shut down toward the partner, but it's really the mother. I just want to bring that up because that's...
I appreciate it because I was chuckling because that was my experience. So I know you also do family constellation work, and I went for a therapy session around that. And that was exactly what came up, that I had inherited this role to be that person for my mother. And then I became too big for her. And she never asked me to take on that role. And that was a way of healing too, but I can definitely appreciate that. And what would come up in my relationships was always not always having this feeling of not being enough, no matter what I did. And that would just...
I want to comment on that. That's actually a great segue into the next thing I'm going to say. So if we are trying to fill our mom's black hole because she's unhappy in her relationship with her dad, first of all, it's not our job. Secondly, it's an impossibility. We're not on the same tier. We're down here. We can never... It's her partner or her parents that do that job. Our job is just to receive and expand. But when we're in that role, we've stopped receiving. We're now giving. And because of that, that's a break in the attachment. Let me say this again. Clear my throat first.
Yeah.
But let me say this again. Let me pour some more tea. Let me say this again for those of us men who sat in this role, if we were a giver to our mother, then we stopped taking in from our mole. And when we couldn't take in, we then didn't get our core. We didn't get the download of the software for well-being. So let me say it this way. Our mom is responsible in the perfect world for installing the software of well-being to the infant, to the baby. And she does this by her consistent attunement. She goes, hold my baby. Oh, there you are. Oh, honey, you're happy. And the child goes, me happy. The child gets this sense of himself through the mother's mirror, the mother's reflection. Or, oh, honey, you're sad. Me sad. So the child's getting this mirror from the mother, this reflection, and then being able to own and live in his own gut knowing that comes from this installation of the software for well-being. When the child is needing to be over there to fill the to make sure the mother's okay, it's not receiving. So I just wanted to say that it's another important distinction.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you expanding on that. Now, coming back to the language piece, in the book, you talk about core language. Yeah. And you've touched on it in some of the stories you've shared. But along the same lines, there's the core sentence and core trauma that you encourage the reader to explore for themselves. How do you tie all of that together? So I think we've touched on the core language piece, but if you can expand on that a little bit more, and how does that then translate to a core sentence and core trauma?
Yeah, they're connected. So basically, one of my favorite tools is this question of the core sentence. So when you answer, here, do you want to see how it works? Do you want me to do it here with the listeners?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Don't try this at home if you don't feel resourced or supported. Only do this, answer this question if you feel, because it could bring up some heavy material. Mm. So here's the advisory. Don't do this at home unless you feel you have old support, or that you can work through this, or you have someone with whom you can work this. Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you the question. Mm. So, okay, listener, if your life were to fall apart, if things went terribly wrong, if your life went south, suddenly just went south, what's your worst fear? What's the worst thing that could happen to you? Feel it. Write it down. I'm going to ask you again. What's your worst fear? If your life fell apart, if things just suddenly went wrong, what's the worst thing that could happen to you? Write it down. Feel it. Okay? Now, if that happened, what's the worst part of that? If that happened to you, what's the worst part of that? They could. Okay, one more time. And if that happened, what's the worst part of that? We're distilling it down.
Yes.
And often people get these sentences that make the body reverberate. For example, they say a sentence like, I'll be abandoned, or I'll be all alone, or there'll be no one there, or they'll leave me, or I'll be helpless, I'll be powerless. Now, those sentences I gave you tell the therapist, oh, we're probably going over into attachment.
Yeah.
But there's another group of sentences that take us into generational trauma. I'll hurt someone. It'll all be my fault. I'll be hated. I'll be sent away. I'll be ostracized. I'll do something terrible. I won't deserve to live. I'll hurt a child. I'll kill somebody. These sentences take us into generational trauma, where the therapist who's in tune would say, did anyone in your family ever hurt a child? That's those types of questions. Did anyone in your family get ostracized? Did somebody do something terrible in the family? Mm-hmm. You can tell what the core trauma in the family is, often by someone's core sentence. Now y'all take your sentence to a therapist who does this work and work with it.
Yeah, no, I think that's really helpful for people that are interested. So you talked about attachment styles. You've touched on it in different ways. I am curious because we talk about attachment styles forming early, right? And then we tend to carry those on. You talked about your own experience of when your mom was gone and how you felt. And one can make the case that maybe you form that attachment style. But what you're also referring to is a lot of the times these get passed down. So
we don't know the difference, actually.
Yeah.
Let me say a couple things. So the new revised version of the book, so it's been out now for just a couple months, and it has this up here. I updated it in 2025. I tell the story about myself that I couldn't tell when my mom was alive, because I'll tell it here, but it's in the book too. My mom didn't want to keep the pregnancy, and she tried to dislodge the pregnancy for all 9 months by having my dad pull her down on her belly on her steps or in any way. And like I said earlier, that's a very important time for neurodevelopment. I came out with a massive distrust of my mom's attunement and also incredible fear response that I would be annihilated. I would be ruined. I would be destroyed. That's what happened in the womb. I wanted to tell that. Now, these responses, these fight, flight, freeze responses, can definitely be heritable because that is transcribed. That, let me use a different word. The genes that are now altered from this response to the trauma, this is what can get passed down to future generations. And we don't know because traumas look the same. So we actually don't know until we do our core sentence. We actually don't know if we're struggling with an attachment trauma because fight response or flight response or freeze response, or we've inherited a fight or flight or freeze response until we just do what we just did, which is locate our trauma language, our core sentence, and trace it back to see what happened in our family. If we say, I'll be left, I'll be abandoned, I'll be rejected, the question is, hey, mom, what happened? Did you and dad take any early vacations? Were you gone for any time? Here's a question I don't know if you can ask, but you can feel it. Was your mom emotionally disconnected? So you didn't have a physical separation, you have an emotional separation, meaning you didn't feel, here's the question I ask in the book, in the new book. Did you feel seen, really seen? Did you feel known by your mom that she could intuition, feel what you were feeling and then intuit what you needed? And then she could soothe you, soothed by your mother, seen, known, and soothed. If the answer is, no, you did not, that's a big T trauma. Mm. And many of us have moms that are matter of fact or flatlined, or they're not good with emotions, or they didn't get enough from their moms. And so they're kind of shut down to our feelings and they can't mirror or be with our feelings because our feelings feel threatening to them. So that's another break. There's all these facets of breaks in the bonds for Colin. We can go for hours and talk about. So I don't teach attachment styles.
Right.
What I do teach is attachment responses. So attachment styles, it's great work. Great work.
Yes.
Well, I'm more interested in the fight, flight, freeze responses that live in our core that then create the attachment style. So the attachment style will come after because we have these visceral responses that come first.
Yeah.
For example, if we have a fight response or we might not trust our part, and then we become might become avoidant. In other words, or we can, our attachment styles come as a result of these. So in my work, I'm more looking at these.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're talking about if our parents weren't able to meet those needs. Now there's a lot of talk about reparenting, right?
Sure.
So we've acknowledged that those needs weren't met, those fundamental needs were not met early on, which disrupted our development. So there is a huge component of, again, talking about agency, where we can reparent ourselves and give ourselves the, those needs that weren't met.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. And in fact, the new book I'm writing, I just had these two books come out this year, and then I'll have another one coming out next year. These are amazing, but I'm not going to sell them. You just read them yourself and see what you think. But I have a new book coming out next year, which is about the effects of attachment and how it often leads to complex illness or dysregulated cores, and which dysregulated cords, inner core leads to compromised health. In fact, the more dysregulation, often the greater the health consequence. But also the book, the first part of the book will talk about how we heal this in ourselves. The next part of the book will talk about how, in other words, how we reparent, you're going to use your word, how we reparent ourselves. This part two is how we use our relationship to heal attachment. And then the third part of the book is what happens when our kids have breaks in the attachment, how we heal our children.
That's excited to hear that's coming out. So I'm looking forward to seeing that, because I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. Now, I do want to get back to the second story that you were going to share of what made you go down this path of doing this work.
Yeah, it's good timing, I think, because this is so interesting for Khan. I don't know squat about inherited trauma. I had no clue until I had this case. So again, this is 30 years ago, and I'm working with a lot of cutters. And this is after my eyesight comes back, I hang out a shingle, I'm taking all these trauma-informed work trainings, somatic trainings, but all these cutters are coming to me, and all these self-injurers are coming to me, and I don't get it. I go, what do I know about that? Of course, I was a self-injurer, but I'm clueless at this time. But this one particular woman, a young woman, she's 24 years old. I'm going to call her Sarah. She cut differently than the other cutters. She cut in an extreme way. In fact, she cut so deeply that she would often hit a vein or an artery and almost bleed to death. And then her parents would rush her to the hospital, and they think she's trying to kill herself. So the hospital would put her in a psych ward for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And I'm thinking, okay, what is going on here? I'd worked with many other cutters. Their cutting is more superficial. What is it about Sarah, the way she's cutting, that's trying to be communicated here? I have no idea. But when she comes out, I hand her a pen. And I go, Sarah, pretend this is your knife and show me what you do. So she goes to put the pen toward her arm, and she's drawing it across her arm. And all of a sudden, I see her eyes glaze over, and she's beginning to dissociate. And I go, Sarah, right there, what's that thought? What's that feeling right there? What's that impulse? And she looks at me, I swear, and she says, I don't deserve to live. And I said, Sarah, what have you done? Did you cause an accident? Did you break up with someone who took his life? And she goes, no, nothing like that. And I have no clue what to do. So I go, it's got to be in her childhood. I missed it. I look again in her childhood for Khan, and it's a great childhood. She can go to her mother for warmth and nurture, and she can go to her dad for love and warmth. So I figure it's got to be the attachment. I've missed it. So I go back into her early life with questions. No, she is a strong, secure, safe attachment with her mom. And then finally, what it comes to me to ask, tell me about your grandparents. And boom, she drops the bomb. Grandma was an alcoholic, dad's parents, later in life. And grandma is driving the car drunk when dad's 12 and crashes into a telephone pole. Grandpa's in the passenger seat. He goes through the windshield, gets cut, lacerated on the glass, and bleeds out, bleeds to death before the ambulance arrives. And in that minute, my mouth drops open. And I went, there is the whole story, who got cut and who didn't deserve to live. So being a student of psychodrama at that time, I was studying with John Nolte at the Psychodrama Institute. I put two chairs in the middle of the room, the middle of the office. And I said, Sarah, look over to that chair and see your grandpa and tell him what you do. She says, Grandpa, I cut myself. I go, no, tell him how deeply you cut. She says, I cut myself so deeply that I almost bleed to death. And then I said, add the words, like you, Grandpa, like you bled to death. And now she's crying. And I right there, I know she's in it. And I go, what's he showing you? What's he showing? What's he saying? She goes, he doesn't want me to do this. And he says, when I go to cut at night, to feel him there supporting me. And I go, okay. Then I say, look at that chair right there and tell your grandma what you told me, that you feel you don't deserve to live. And she goes, Grandma, I told Mark I don't deserve to live. And I said, add the words like you would have felt, Grandma. And now she's crying. And the same thing. Both of her grandparents are dead, or in the spirit world, telling her that when she goes to cut, that they will be with her, supporting her. And for Khan, she never cuts again. So I'm kind of blown away by the whole deal. And I start going, okay, how do I learn about this? What do I do? And sure enough, I find Bert Hellinger, and I become one of his earliest students in North America.
Wow. Yeah, that's a powerful story. And as I'm hearing it, is just a lot of things coming up. So I'll try to talk at least the first two that are coming up. First is, it's such a gift to be able to offer this to people, right? And because as we've already touched on it, so many people are suffering and not able to understand why. And the thing that's coming up for me is that, unfortunately, I've gone to schooling to become a psychologist, but we don't learn these things, right? And it's obviously, you've come across it through personal experience and having stories like this, but why is this work not talked about so much?
Yeah, that's my battle, right? That's my battle. That's why I wrote the book, actually. And thank goodness it's in the curriculum of a lot of universities now. Massively. It is being taught now. Hey, before I answer that question, let me go back to something you said, or something that's now in my head that I can't get rid of. So going back to core language, I want to go back to Sarah's story, because her verbal core language is, I don't deserve to live. And when we traced it back, we could see this needing to die wasn't hers. But her nonverbal core language also could be traced back, which is almost bleeding out, cutting so deeply, she's almost bleeding to death. And that was a particular language that we were able to trace back, and we got the story. So now let's get back to universities and psychology schools. Thank goodness the zeitgeist has changed, and people are now saying, okay, inherited trauma. So I'm very grateful. You know, my book has sold 3 million copies.
Yeah.
And, but I wanted to, okay. So about a year ago, year and a half ago, I go to my editor and I say, okay, look, I know the book does well, but I want to rewrite it. He goes, no, don't touch it. It's good as it is. And I said, I promise I'll leave the bones, but I've got to add all the new science that's been happening with humans, because the book talked a lot about rodents and mice and rats and how we're similar. But now all this science came out with Pakistani orphans and Syrian war refugees and current humans that are struggling. So I revised the book, told deeper stories. I actually tell the story of Sarah in there, but I also have different insights now, 10 years later, and different things we've learned. Trauma is not just three generations. It can extend out for five generations. Yeah. So if you bought my last book, throw it away. Yeah, I'm kidding. You don't have to. It still holds up very well, actually. But I really designed the new book to be absolutely current with all the new science. There's so many cool studies that are released. There's this one study where they look at, for example, Brazilian women that experience partner violence that were pregnant. So these women who went on to have daughters who then got pregnant and had daughters themselves, they were able to pass these gene changes, this partner violence reactivity through changes in DNA methylation, which is one of the mechanisms that it blocks the proteins from attaching to the DNA and suppresses its expression. But anyway, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad to hear that there's more work going on to understand this better. And hopefully conversations like this too are helping people learn more about this. The other thing you talked about, so this was the second thing that was coming up for me, and it's something you touched on before we started this recording too, is the spiritual side. And as you were sharing Sarah's story, you talked about or alluded to her grandparents speaking to her from the spiritual world. How does this fit in to your work? And I'm always fascinated with the spiritual piece because, as I was mentioning to you, I think there's so much healing that can happen when we realize that maybe part of our purpose in this world or in this realm is to heal that trauma that's been passed down.
Absolutely.
And we can change future generations.
Absolutely. I want to start there because I like what you said. I believe that too. I believe we come in feeling separated. Often this happens through the break in the attachment on purpose. Yes. I believe that the design is why 85 to 90% of us have breaks in the attachment with our mom, because that's a break in the attachment with our core, with ourself, a break from our gut knowing. And then we go through life trying to find ourselves again. And the beauty here is along the way, we have a dark night of the soul, and then we get on the hero's journey, and then we have to find our body voice and the red light. What's a red light in our body? No. What's a green light in our body? Yes. We have to learn how to trust ourselves. We have to learn how not to be a people pleaser, how not to be an overgiver, which we talked about that, why we become overgivers. We gave to our sad mother, or how not to seek other people's approval and learn that validation comes from within. We have to learn how to have boundaries and to speak our truth, which even if it's not popular. So I do believe, as you're saying, that there is this spiritual design to feel disconnected from ourselves, to come back, to be connected to ourselves. Now, you ask me another question. How could Sarah heal through talking to her grandparents who are dead? We heal, and I talk about this in the books, through our inner images. We heal through our inner sensations, through experiencing positive sensations, having positive experiences, being with those positive feelings and sensations, but also how we hold these images. So Sarah, she was able to receive comfort and support, which is one of the ways we feed the prefrontal cortex. Curiosity, awe, gratitude, loving kindness, mindfulness, these things that feed these states, feeling states that feed the prefrontal cortex and get us out of the limbic brain.
Yes.
So Sarah was able to feel in her inner image the comfort and support of her grandparents, which put her in the zone, in a deeper state of consciousness that changed the way her body felt. So she could feel supported in a new way. Even though she felt that by her mom and her dad, she was able to feel this greater support by something bigger. Maybe this idea that death doesn't end us, that we don't die, that we live on. Maybe that's what she needed, to see that her grandma and grandpa were very much there. People ask me all the time, Mark, how do I heal the broken bond with my mom when she's passed away? And I always say, hey, go get a picture of your mom when she was alive, when she was in her 20s and 30s, and put it up over your left shoulder, over your nightstand or over your left shoulder above your pillow, and look at her picture at night, even if you had a bad relationship with her. And now that she's in the spirit world, trust that she can, there's more to deliver, that she couldn't do it in life from the personality, because the personality was encumbered, but there's no personality in the spirit world. There's the soul. We could basically say, Mom, please hold me while I'm sleeping so we can heal this break in the bond and I can feel connected with you. And we could even add the words, Mom, teach me how to trust your love, how to receive it, and how to let it in without taking care of you, Mom, like I did when I was a kid. Just receiving. And then I tell the reader, this is my book, my new book. This is the revised book. Then I tell the reader to feel a current of energy, to feel a force of life, a life force come through the photo into the body, literally, that we can experience as life force, vitality, aliveness, tingling, electricity, pulsing, something, some visceral experience that we can believe in, we can trust in. So if somebody said, what are you doing? My mom is sending this energy from the spirit world into my body, and I'm grooving on it, and it makes me feel good.
And I see this a lot, and I think I struggled with this too, is we tend to condemn our parents for what they did or didn't do, but they were also limited in their capacity at times. And perhaps their role is to bring us into this world and do whatever they can from a caregiving standpoint. But speaking of the spirit world, I think when you connect to your higher power, you realize that, okay, before my higher power, I'm also someone who can do things for myself. And if that connection is there, then I can still have love and compassion for my parents for their lack at times.
Furqan, you've brought up so many points here. I don't know where to start, but it's good. Let me start with the first one.
Yes,
when we are living in our core, connected to our wisdom self, integrated inner child, higher self, we have more options, for sure.
Yes,
it's a nice way to say it. But when we stay in that rejection and that blame and that anger, I find that when we still are feeling that blame, that rejection, it works inside us unconsciously, three different ways. So the first way is that if we blame our parents for being cold or cruel, we will unconsciously reject aspects of ourselves. And we can't see when we're the same. We've disowned, I'll never be cold. So we've disowned that behavior in ourselves. But then it expresses us inside us unconsciously. And then we are cold, but we can't see it. So the first way is we will often express unconsciously what we've disowned. The second way is we will pull in unconsciously a partner who does the same thing to us. So if we thought our mother was distant or our dad was distant, we'll pull in a distant partner. And what's interesting is even if they're not distant, we'll see them as distant. I always say, man, you could turn a good guy bad or a good woman bad just by your hypervigilance, you're waiting for them to give you what you felt your parents gave you. But the deeper one, the third unconscious one, is we will treat ourselves unconsciously, the child part of us, the way we feel we were treated. So if our parents couldn't be gentle with us, well, we'll have difficulty being gentle with that child part inside us, or we'll do to ourselves what we believe was done to us. So if our parents were critical or aggressive, we'll be self-critical or inwardly aggressive. Or if our parents ignored us or were distant with us, we will be distant with ourselves. We'll ignore our inner child. So I always say, if you can do it, if you can heal with them, do it. Now, the funny thing is, I also say this in the book again and again, that it's an inside job. And a lot of times we can't do it on the outside because our parents aren't safe. So we have to do it in our inner images. So your mom's alive, but you can't, you know, if you go back home, you'll find yourself collapsing or shrinking or going into caretaking mode. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Instead, work with her photo. Mom, I know you would have, she's alive. I know you would have given me more if you had gotten more from your mother. And I can't do this in real life with you, but I can certainly do it with this photo. In other words, healing doesn't have to be in person. It's so funny, Furkan. I took a lot of heat on the book. Mark Lynn makes you heal with toxic parents. No, I don't. People go, I'm not going to heal with my parents. Terrible. But we still must do the work at least inwardly in our images. If we're not, good luck in your relationships because you are projecting all that gunk on your partner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And along those lines of the inner work, you've touched on integration over and over again.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about integration today in different contexts. And I don't know if we fully appreciate what integrating means, because to me, the way I've internalized it is it's an ongoing process. I'm accumulating new information, which I need to integrate. Something else happens. I learn from that. I realize, oh, maybe there's something else coming up here. How do I now integrate? So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this integration piece, especially in the context of what we're talking about and this inner work as you're touching on.
Okay. Let's say, great question and an important question. Let's say you've found your core sentence. Well, my core sentence is I'll be abandoned. I'll be, Mom, did any, what? You and Dad were thinking of separating during the time when I was in the womb or when I was two or one, and I have no memory. Oh my God. So what that does is it allows us to locate in time and space what happened. Okay, in the womb or when I was a baby, my mom and dad were thinking of breaking up, or Dad had an affair, or he started drinking, whatever it was, or Mom had to go away for school, or I stayed at Grandma's for a month, or whatever it is. Now we know that we're working with a particular trauma. Now we have to find out how that trauma, which is very clear, how the effects of that trauma are operating in our body. Oh, I feel tight when my partner comes close, or I perceive my partner as a bad person when they're actually very nice, or we start to see how it works. Now, what's the next step? We've got to locate what feels uncomfortable in the body. We've got to be with the uncomfortable sensations in our body until we can reach what's beneath them. I said this earlier, but I'll say it again. Sensations that we experience as life-giving. Because we need somewhere to integrate this in, right? We can't just hold a little teddy bear on our lap and go, that's my inner child, because that doesn't do it. We need to actually get deep in the body. So we might put our hand where we feel the sensation of being tight or frozen, and then bring that young part of ourselves deep within to where there's life force pulsing, tingling, expanding, blood flowing, waves of energy. And then we need to be able to hold these sensations for at least a minute and repeat it 6 times a day. That's what I say in the book. That's the magic number. For me, is 60 seconds times 6. So 6 times a day, we're looking at our tightness in our chest. We're saying, I've got you. I'm going to breathe with you. I've got you. Oh, there you go. You're coming in deep to where I can feel this current of energy. That's good. For me, that's one of the ways we heal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that. And last question. So we touched on it a little bit.
You mean we're not going to talk all day?
I would love to, but I know you've got a lot of work to do yourself, right? But we're seeing a lot of trauma perhaps being projected outward in the world we find ourselves in. And we can only speak about the times we're living in. Obviously, historically, maybe there's a little bit of that too. But as a clinician, how do you see these dynamics playing out in how people are behaving? And not to, again, coming back to what I said earlier, not to condemn anyone, but that inherited trauma and how it's being projected outward. That was something you and I touched on, but I want to expand on.
Yeah, it's an important question. Look, I find that those of us that are hit hardest, events in the outside world, are actually, we can use that because we look at what it's bringing up. Oh, it's bringing up fear. It's bringing up shrinking. It's bringing up nausea. We can actually use that to heal. What I find is often the break in the attachment where we didn't feel safe, and now we don't feel safe in the world. So we can use what's happening out there to locate and then direct where that work needs to happen in here. So that's the one thing I want to say. And the second thing I want to say is, don't look for politics to save us, because it's not going to save us. It doesn't matter which team's in the White House or who's doing what. What matters is our inner work, because when we do our inner work, we have more choices. We have more choices to look at, are we going to react in fear, or are we going to react with openness? Are we going to shut down, or are we going to build community? Are we going to create division or be part of the division that's happening out there, which we know never works? Because whenever we exclude somebody in that division, that just feeds the cycle of repetition. Whoever we leave out, whoever we push away, reemerges in our personal life as a boss or a friend
or
that betrays
teacher.
Us. All of it. Let's all do our inner work so we have less reactivity and we can become more loving. We can give love, receive love, build community.
Yeah. No, I love that. Powerful reminder that it's easy to get sucked into that, but if we bring it back to ourselves and just do that inner work, what I found is I'm not even reacting to those things. And I think you said this before we even jumped on the recording, is you can just observe. Just be an observer of all of this playing out and just have compassion for everyone involved, as hard as it can be at times.
Totally. Yeah. Step up, zoom back.
Yes.
And look at what's happening out here and recognize there really are two timelines. Whereas those of us that are caught in what's happening, and there are those of us that are building community and strengthening our connections and working on our relationships and feeling connected to the earth and taking our shoes off and walking on the land and sitting in the sun, that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Mark, thank you so much for this conversation. Now, you've talked about all your work that's out there, including your books. So people, if they want to learn more or even maybe do the workbook assignments and learn more about their core sentences and language, what are some ways they can find all of that and get access to everything?
So I want to say one more thing about the workbook, which I didn't, because it's important.
Yes.
Everybody's into family constellations now, but we have to know where a family constellation is and get a good facilitator. So what I tried to do in the book, and it happened successfully, is I teach the reader how to do his or her own family constellations, to stand as our younger self, or to stand as our mother or our father on flip-flops or slippers or shoes that we place in the room, to experience what they felt, or to stand as our grandfather that we never met, or to stand as our father who wasn't liked by our mother, or to stand as our mother who didn't feel supported by our father. All of this, so we can have this visceral experience of having a family constellation. So that's in the workbook. That's one of the big pieces in there. So how you find me, thank you for that. I just feel I'm in love with these new books. I put a lot of work into them.
Yes.
I really did. And it's like, I can't work with everybody. I can only do so many private sessions. So I had to figure out a way, how do I work with the world? I did it in the workbook, I think. But anyway, how do you find me? MarkWolin.com, Instagram, Facebook. Yeah, I have a training online for those who want to learn how to either bring this into your clinical practice or to go deep, deep within.
Okay, we'll definitely put all of that in the show notes. But thanks again, Mark. Really appreciate your time and sharing all the wisdom and insight that you've gathered over the years.
I really enjoyed this, Furkan. I felt like we had I felt like we delivered something pretty cool. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Mark. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader to then implement in their lives. You can find the link to the newsletter in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.